Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tipps again, and it is Wednesday. It's December 12th. It's 12-12-12, and it's a special day, I guess. And the reason it's special is because we actually have with us today a gentleman who has been quite instrumental in nutritional therapy for decades, as well as health freedom, as well as you name it when it comes to health and nutrition, and he's been there, done it, probably bought the T-shirt, made the T-shirt, and is someone you all need to hear. And this gentleman is none other than Gray Graham. And Gray Graham is not only a nutritional educator par excellence, he has taught hundreds of classes to probably many thousands of healthcare professionals, not only in the United States where he's based, but also all over the world. And his presentations on nutrition have educated many, many people, you know, people like professionals like chiropractors, naturopaths, osteopaths, and of course, those medical doctors who have open minds and will listen, as well as acupuncturists and dentists. So this is someone who's been around the block and knows what is what. He has co-developed and he's co-taught this program that's called the Nutritional Therapist Training Program, and has really taught nutrition to many people. In fact, some of whom are with the National Health Federation who have learned from this program. And he's also a lecturer for the Price-Pottinger Nutrition Foundation, which if you haven't heard of it, you sure should. The Price-Pottinger, Pottinger, E-N-G-E-R, Nutrition Foundation. And, you know, dearest to my heart actually is that Gray Graham is Biotics Research, donated money to the NHF to help send us to the recent Codex Nutrition Committee meeting in Germany that was held just last week where we had, quite an impact. So Gray, thank you for coming on the program and thank you for that donation. You're quite a friend because of all of that. So are you there?
Yes, I am, Scott. Well, thanks. Oh. That was a very gracious introduction, and it was my pleasure to, you know, help facilitate that trip. I mean, there's a saying that the cost of freedom is constant diligence, and certainly the cost of health freedom is constant diligence. And I certainly appreciate, you know, the tremendous amount of work that you and your team do to, you know, protect all of our rights to have access to healthy and whole foods and appropriate nutritional supplements. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, gosh, you honor me by being on. And I just, you know, I apologize. We got a little to the audience and certainly to Gray. We got a little bit of a late start as we tried to make the technical connections, but we have him here. So I want to really kind of launch right into it. And one of the things that I did not mention is that you co-authored a book, which I actually have right here in front of me, which has the most interesting title. And I know you've done a couple of them, but the one I have in front of me is Pottinger's Prophecy. And could you tell me, please, a little bit about that book and who was this Pottinger person and why is his message important to us?
Yeah, well, I've actually got involved in nutrition really relatively late at night. I was 40 years old and expecting the birth of my first child. And I got involved with a company that sold nutritional supplements. And I came under the mentorship of a very wise nutritionist. And one of the things he told me was that if I wanted to understand nutrition and really wanted to see kind of some of the truths, that I needed to read two books. The first was a book by Weston A. Price called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. And really that book profoundly, you know, changed my understanding of nutrition. And to this day, whenever a new concept comes up in nutrition, I always ask myself, you know, what would Weston Price's work tell us about that? And then the second person that the foundation was named after, Francis Pottinger, was a medical doctor, and he also did a profound study on cats. And so a lot of people have heard of the study of Pottinger's cats. And what Francis Pottinger showed with his cat study was that when you take an incorrect diet and feed it to cats, that what happens is obviously when a mother cat is given inappropriate food, its kittens aren't as healthy. But what he showed which was prophetic, is that if you hold an improper diet constant over several generations, that each generation actually gets sicker than the generation before it. And he actually carried that experiment for three generations on processed foods with cats, cooked foods. And what he found was that by the end of the third generation, that there were these profound changes that had taken place. Almost in one of his most classic experiments, he just simply changed the type of milk from raw milk, which would be the natural food of cats. Well, you know, could be debated whether adult cats, that's really a natural food, but it certainly is a healthy right. food for them. And then subsequently, he just simply pasteurized it in one group. In another group, he condensed it. In another group, he sweetened and condensed it. And what he found is that in all three groups of the processed milk, that the cats degenerated, and they degenerated progressively over three generations. And at the end of three generations, in the third generation cats, they were so degenerated in almost every way. Their structures were narrow, and their teeth were all crooked. Now, God, as I'm saying this, I want you to just kind of think of the children that we see today. You know, they yes. had narrow, crooked teeth. They had socialization problems, that some of the cats became reclusive and some of them became aggressive, and that they started having sexual dysfunction. Either the cats, some of them lost interest in sex. See any of that today, you know, particularly right. As people get a little bit older, or they had interest in sexual activity, but it was inappropriate activity for cats, or they had sexual activity, but they were sterile, or they actually conceived, but the kittens were born stillborn. So at the end of the third generation, he couldn't even reproduce any healthy offspring. So he reversed that study, and he took these degenerated cats and he put them back on the diet of the control cats, which was raw meat and raw milk, right. and they regenerated. But it took four generations to restore the cats back to their physical perfection. And so when I read that, the term epigenetics was so uncommon as to be almost unknown. I always said, after I heard that and I looked around at the children, I said, you know what? This is what's happening to us. If you look at the kids today, everything that Pottinger predicted is happening. Like, for example, what he found is that the raw milk cats, not one single cat ever developed an allergy to milk. But even if it was only pasteurized, by the third generation of cats, every single kitten was allergic to milk. And in fact, he documented the very first case of kitty asthma.
Kitty asthma. That's incredible. Well, it does make sense. And you think about the generation that we have, our generations going on now, subsisting on a diet of Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's or whatever. And what are their offspring going to be like, and the offspring of that offspring?
I think we're kind of seeing it. Well, I think there's been profound changes in the human diet many times in our history, you know, starting with, you know, the agricultural revolution. But at the turn of the century, we started eating a lot more processed food, and you saw some of the consequences. But really, probably the craziest thing that humans have ever embarked on is this idea that fat is bad for you. And, you know, with Ansel Keys, you know, Seven Nations study, you know, and people massively believing that, you know, a low-fat diet was good for us. We changed the diet again in the late 60s, early 70s. This is a very low-fat, very high glycemic carbohydrate diet. And really the children today that we're seeing today, born since the year 2000, they're really kind of like the third generation of Pottinger's people. And you can see their obesity rate is through the roof. The Center for Disease Control has told us that, based on their predictions, which I think now are proving to be conservative, that one third of all children born after the year 2000 are going to become diabetic in their lifetime. So can you even imagine? Can you imagine what the consequences that'll be, Scott, if that happens?
Huge consequences and a great burden on the healthcare system, let alone on each individual's lives and quality of life. Absolutely,
That's true.
And the shortness. So it's you know, that never ceases to amaze me, Gray, that people don't understand the consequences of their food choices and of what they're doing. And even, you know, in Europe, you see all these smokers around. Every time you turn around, there's a smoker. And of course, they think it looks really absolutely great. They look cool. They could be in a movie even. But the reality is they're just totally hurting their health, and the same thing with their food choices. And then you add to it the toxins that are in the environment and the electromagnetic fields and the electromagnetic smog that's around, and we have a real soup of problems. And so that's why I found your book very interesting, because it pointed a way out. And it seems like the science of epigenetics, I mean, can you tell our listeners what is this new science of epigenetics?
Well, for so many years, you know, the idea that genes controlled our destiny has really been the prevailing paradigm. And to some degree, they do. But really, what's more important than are the genes that we get, it's how those genes are expressed. Because what we know now, since the Human Genome Project, is that there's roughly 25,000 genes that make up the human genome, but those ability, the combinations in which they can be expressed are like 50 to 100 times as large as the genome itself. So if you're kind of imagine that, if you were to think of a basketball being the genome, then a marble in the center of that would be the genes. And so, mm-hmm. So people always go, it's kind of a cop out. You know, people go, well, yes, I'm diabetic, but my mother was diabetic and my grandfather was diabetic, or yes, I've got heart disease, but it runs in the family. But that's really not true, because as early as 100 years ago, there were almost no coronary artery disease at all. And now, you know, it's like 50% of the population, or actually 75% of the people in America can expect to have heart disease in their lifetime, and like 47% of the people will die from heart disease. So if it was genetic, that would have been true 100 years ago and 200 years ago and 400 years ago. It's just simply not genetic. It's an expression of the genes, whether genes are switched on or switched off as a result of the environment. And, you know, I'm a nutritionist, so I do think that the most profound change is because of the diet, but all those things you mentioned, and we talk about in the book, you know, so simple herbicides have been shown, the herbicide vinclozolin has been shown to affect the male offspring of experimental rats for four generations. So if you expose a mother rat to vinclozolin, the offspring will have, higher propensity for sterility and prostate cancer and kidney tumors, but that's the direct offspring. But their offspring and their offspring and the offspring after them even can actually be even more affected than the first generation because of this epigenetic effect, the fact that the vinclozolin switched genes that for propensity towards cancer and towards sterility, and unless you do something to switch those genes back, they get passed on from generation to generation to generation. And, we don't have any idea what we're doing with all these chemicals and with these GMOs. We have no idea what genetically modified foods are doing in terms of switching bad genes on and good genes off.
Mm. Well, it seems to me that, well, my father died young of a heart attack, so he was quite young. But I don't fear that, because I've been, engaging in good nutrition mostly for the most part. Of course, I have lapses here and there, but in terms of supplementation and all of that since I was 17 years old. So I feel, pretty confident about that. And I've already outlived him by a good number of years. But, say for practical purposes, epigenetically, what would someone who has, a history, if they did have a history of heart disease in their family or cancer, what would they do practically, Graham, to prevent this from hurting them or being a problem for them?
Well, I think a lot of the conventional wisdom in our book, we actually talk about the 10 green gene food guidelines. And I think whether it's heart disease or cancer or whatever, I think that making these types of choices, these 10 things can make a profound difference. But also, you know, to as great a degree as possible, you know, is getting the toxins out of our environment, you know, eating organic foods, and eating as much as possible a nutrient dense, you know, properly prepared whole food diet, as opposed to the highly processed, fractionated diet that most people are eating. But you want me to talk about some of the Green Gene guidelines that we talk about in the book?
Yeah, if you don't mind. Actually, it's funny. I just turned to page 174 of your book, where it starts with item number one, and it all seems very good common sense guidelines. They seem like good common sense guidelines to me. But yes, please, you could say it better than I.
Okay. Well, I think they're all kind of basic, and they make sense. Certainly, it's not the only things, but, you know, first of all, we need to eat a fresh whole food diet in its natural state as often as possible. And as you know, Scott, because you travel a lot, sometimes it's just not that easy.
Yeah, it's tough.
Can just use the 80-20 rule, or hopefully the 90-10 rule, and 90% of the time we can eat good foods. And another really big mistake that people make is they eat a very small variety of foods, even if they're healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, people will tend to have 5 to 10 mm-hmm. foods that they eat constantly, whereas our Paleolithic and even our ancestors a few hundred years ago ate hundreds of different types of foods, which gave them a broad spectrum of nutrients that people aren't getting. And you know, when you eat a small variety of foods, it's very easy to create imbalances.
That's a good point. I think I tend to be guilty of that one, actually.
Yeah, so I know it's easy to kind of get, you know, like I try to have fresh fruit every morning, and there's certain things I prefer, you know, so it's easy to say, oh, I'm going to have grapefruit again today, you know, but really try and every day have fruit, but have a different fruit. You know, there's so many different types of fruit. And then, of course, a little bit further down the list, but try and find fruits that are in season and indigenous to the area that you're at. And then thirdly, you know, it's really important, you know, I mean, I do believe that we are by nature omnivores. Not that you can't be healthy as a vegetarian, but most of us do eat meat, and it's very important to select organic, grass-fed, free-range, local, and sustainable foods, you know, whenever possible. And fortunately, more and more, you know, we're developing these great communities of food, you know, locally. I know where I live here in the Northwest, I live in Olympia, Washington. There's just a variety of farmers markets and local farms and food co-ops and CSAs and stuff that really make it so much more possible than it was just even 5 or 10 years ago. And then we need to pay attention to having a proper portions of proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. You know, fats are very, very important for our health. And this idea, this crazy, stupid idea that fat is somehow bad for us. There are fats that are bad for us, but they're not necessarily the ones that we've been told. You know, they're these highly processed, hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils, and these vegetable oils like cottonseed oil and, you know, canola oil and soybean oil that are, though they may not always be inherently bad, they're so highly processed and so devoid of any fat-soluble nutrients and so completely out of balance with our omega-3 fatty acids that they're really, really hurting us. So I think the things that we've been told, you know, saturated fats and, you know, and, you know, monounsaturated fats and things, we know that as in appropriate proportions of high quality, that all fats except for those highly processed fats can be a very healthy part of our diet.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of this sounds just very commonsensical, and yet it's something that many of us, including me, yours truly, overlook or forget or even ignore. So what's the fourth one, would you say? Or did we get to three?
We got to four. I think we're to six. I kind of combined a few there. Sorry.
Oh, I see.
So, and I touched on six even a little bit, that we really need to do our very best to get plant and animal foods that have been grown or raised on a sustainable and nutrient-rich soil, because so much of our food is produced on these huge factory farms, both animal and plants, that from soil that's depleted and then pumped up with artificial fertilizers that make plants that look like plants but don't have those amazing phytonutrients that sustain us and give us health.
Okay.
And then number seven, I'll run through these real quick because there's plenty of other things to talk about. When we eat fish, is a very, very good food if it's from non-polluted waters and it's wild caught. So we're now finding that so much of the fish is farm raised, and not to condemn it across the board, but almost across the board, most of it, you know, has the same type of imbalances that factory raised meats have. And that I read a study recently that farmed salmon has about the same, you know, fatty acid profile as industrial, you know, beef. You know, so people really think they're making a good choice by getting salmon, but if you're not careful, they'll have that. If it says North Atlantic salmon, almost always, like 99% of the time, that's a key that it's farm raised. And if it's farm raised, it's not anywhere near as healthy. Maybe even can say it's unhealthy, and that we should avoid that. And then
I just interrupt if I may, Gray. I noticed on the farm raised, if it's not organically raised, they've added in a lot of antibiotics and other things that people would definitely not want. So I would think that's a big problem too. In fact, actually, I've heard if you're going to have salmon at all, and correct me if I'm wrong now with the Fukushima nuclear accident, that really the Alaskan salmon is absolutely the best the wild salmon, I mean, is absolutely the best in that respect. What do you think about
that? Okay. Well, I think Alaska is still, you know, to a very large degree, a pristine environment, and because of the currents, it didn't get any of the radioactivity from the meltdown. And so, I mean, I think there's other salmons down here in Washington. I think it's decent. It's certainly not as good of Alaska because of the industrial pollution. You know, the Puget Sound has been such a great source of wild fish, but now it's becoming more and more polluted. And excuse me. And then the last two, drink clean water. People aren't drinking any water. You know, people drink diuretics all day. They get up and have three cups of coffee and they drink tea and they don't get the water. And so many times, you know, the water is not clean. You know, it's chlorinated and fluoridated and has all kinds of residual chemicals in it and stuff. So at the very least, have a high quality filter, but whenever possible, try to find natural spring. We're really lucky where I live here. We have artesian wells that coming out of the ground all over our town, and the city recently took one of them and, you know, made a little park around it. So everybody in our community can go and get absolutely pure, clean artesian water whenever they want. But unfortunately, most people don't have that benefit.
Well, you are lucky in that respect. So you don't have to go and pollute yourself with plastic bottled water and get the chemicals leached into the water from the plastic either.
No, I know that's for so long, you know, we really believed that we needed to be drinking, you know, bottled water. And you certainly can have, you know, healthy bottled water, but if it's in a plastic container, it's really suspect because of the bisphenol A, that BPA. And we talk about it in the book at length, how really devastating that BPA is on our genetic expression and why we should avoid it. And, you know, certainly a mistake I'd made in the past was to have a bottle of water in plastic and leave it in a hot car. And then, you know, it has that plasticky taste. And that's a really, really big mistake because that leaches so much of that bisphenol A out, and it's really, really bad. And then the last tip is just simply to give consideration to the other aspects of a meal. You know, the way we eat now, you know, people drive through fast food restaurant and get their food, and then they driving to their next appointment, you know, trying to get to the bank or, you know, off to wherever, you know, eating food while they're driving, or they're eating alone, or eating in unappetizing circumstances. And we know that, you know, that when you don't take the time to appreciate your food, it doesn't nourish you as well. You know, that's why almost every culture that we've ever, from every religious sect and every different ethnic group, they almost always have some type of of ritual for blessing the food or saying grace, or at the very least, if we all just, when we get a meal in front of us, is to take a second and pause and, you know, take a few deep breaths and feel gratitude for the food and, you know, some respect. If we just have a little respect for our food, we'd probably make better choices, but in any case, it would be healthier for us.
You know, it's funny you say that because, and I can't remember where I read this, Gray, but, you know, on the acid alkaline balance question, and there are people that come down on both sides, but generally most people seem to want alkalinizing foods because they're healthier for the body. But someone, I read somewhere, I should say, and who knows if it's true or not, that the simple act of praying or meditating over your food before you eat it will actually slightly change the food into being more alkaline. Now, I don't know who tested it. I don't know if you've heard anything on that, but it sure dovetails nicely with what you just said.
Mm-hmm. No, I think there's been some good studies done. My co-authors, Deborah Keston and Larry Sherwitz, they mm-hmm. actually wrote a book called The Enlightened Diet, and they really talk about the non-nutritive aspects of food and really demonstrated that, you know, depending on how people perceive their food and that it makes a kind of a profound effect. They actually did a study where they identified, you know, unhealthy eating habits that led to obesity that was a completely yes. independent factor from the quality of the food.
Well, you know, that makes a lot of sense because I do think the environment in which you eat the food can really make or break your digestion or your absorption rate or whatever it might be there that would help you out with that. So, but I'm glad we went through the different choices that are the different aspects, the green gene guides. And if someone follows these 10 steps, then what can they expect from that, Gray?
Well, they can expect, you know, the best outcome from the genes that they've been given. You know, because what we know now, you know, we used to think, well, that we were determined by our genes, but now we know that only less than 10%, and some scientists say that less than 2% of human disease has anything to do with our genetic destiny, and that 95% of it is really epigenetically determined. So when we take these simple steps to eat appropriate diet in the appropriate way, that we hugely you know, reduce our chances of expressing heart disease or cancer or Alzheimer's or all these things that, befall us. You know, I mean, to me, what I see, because I spend a lot of time talking to young people and I spend a lot of time around young people, and they don't, when they feel good, they don't have a lot of regards for their diet. I go, gosh, do you really want to order French fries, you know, when they're cooked in these horrible hydrogenated fats, and they go, oh, I don't know, I really like French fries, and they don't seem to bother me. You know, that's one thing to say that when you're 25, but when you're 47 and you're having chest pains, you know, those 25 French fries you ate when you're 25 come back at you. And I think it's kind of one of the saddest things is that people don't get motivated until they have a problem, which you know, I mean, I guess that's what keeps me in business in the supplement business, is because once people, you know, start to have these symptoms, then all of a sudden they're very motivated to, if not change their diet, at least to try and, you know, get the nutrients that will, you know, reverse or at least slow down these progressive problems. Because really, Scott, almost everything that people suffer from today is, you know, from arthritis, osteoarthritis, allergies, heart disease, cancer, et cetera. Those are all primarily, you know, diet and secondarily environmental, you know, yes, considerations
that people can have control over to a large extent. And well, let me ask you about a particular problem. So, you know, you are a nutritionist. In fact, one of the things I didn't say at the beginning of the program is that you're actually the founder of the Nutritional Therapist Association, the NTA, which is quite a nice and prominent group in the United States. And so in your experience, all these people who have been suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome and all of that, how would you deal with it epigenetically, or how would you deal with it nutritionally? What do you think?
My basic philosophy that I've taught for a little background on that, for many years, starting about 1993, including to the present, I've taught a series of seminars to healthcare practitioners. And then starting in 2001, I started the Nutritional Therapist Training Program, but they both have fundamentally the same underlying philosophy. So what I see, a mistake that I see people do when they turn to nutritional therapy for a problem is they let's say somebody's having insomnia, you know, so they go, oh, well, I'm going to do something natural. So they get melatonin or 5-hydroxytryptophan or something like that. But for the most part, people don't have a problem like a problem sleeping because, or osteoarthritis or heart disease or, you know, diabetes because they're missing, you know, one nutrient or herb. They get those things because they have this kind of ongoing weakness in five foundational issues over a long period of time. And I've actually convinced myself, and I'm trying to convince a lot of other people too, that, you know, that the answer to restoring health isn't to, you know, find the herb or the nutrient, you know, that treats the condition, the final condition, but to go back and rebuild these foundations. And that's what I preach to my classes, that the five foundations that are weak in our culture is that people aren't digesting properly. You know, we sell billions of dollars worth of over-the-counter and prescriptive drugs that relieve symptoms and make people's digestion worse. You know, so the first thing to get anybody healthy, particularly with nutritional therapy, is to get them digesting again. And there's a lot of great dietary and supplement ideas that can do that. So if somebody can't sleep or they have arthritis or they have asthma or allergies or whatever, the first thing you want to do is get them digesting. And then secondarily, what's a plague, you know, upon us all is these high glycemic diets and sugar dysregulation that are leading to metabolic syndrome. One of the major health insurance companies said that by 2020, everybody in America would either be 50% of all Americans by 2020 will be either diabetic or pre-diabetic. And so fundamental to health, whatever the problem is you've got to get that blood sugar re-regulated. You have to do that to a degree with diet, but you can also make very, very, very quick progress by using, you know, therapeutic nutrients like chromium and B vitamins and selenium and zinc and things like that. And then thirdly, you know, people are they're either deficient in or imbalanced in their fatty acids. And so I think when I started 20 years ago, you know, people didn't really get that, you know, that there was a big difference between an omega-3 fat and omega-6 fat. And not to say one or the other is bad inherently, but they have to be in balance, and they're not. And that also that we need a variety of fats, including saturated and monounsaturated fats, and not just to get the fats, but to get the fat-soluble nutrients to go with it. So so we've got, just to recap, people have to digest, they have to get their blood sugar regulated, they need good fatty acids. They also need good minerals because with, you know, our food is so mineral deficient, both in macro and micro. You know, so if you don't have any chromium in your diet, you can't make insulin. Or if you don't have selenium, your immune system can't work. If you don't have zinc, you know, there's so many things that don't work, you know, including our immune system and sexual function. Right. And so that's for the fifth one. Where people really are failing, which I've already touched on a little bit, is that they're generally dehydrated. You know, people aren't getting enough water, and they're not getting the electrolytes that hold the water. And so those five foundational issues, and then the foundation of those foundations is, you know, good, nutrient-dense, whole food, low glycemic diet. You know, I'm not saying everybody has to go on a paleo diet, but we've got to get all these refined grains and refined carbohydrates and all those massive amounts of sugar and these very, very nasty things like high fructose corn syrup and these artificial sweeteners. You know, they've just got to go, you know. So
are you there? I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was taking a little break
there. No, for some reason, my sound just went down, and so I didn't know if I had somehow cut myself off. Well, no, that's very helpful. But there was a question that someone asked, and that's what I was looking for. They were asking something, and I think I know the answer to it, actually, but you're the expert, not me, Gray. So, and again, for those of you who are just joining us, and that's some of the people online, we have Gray Graham, who is an incredible teacher of nutrition and health and has taught many thousands throughout the world. And we are very fortunate to have him on the line now, and we're just discussing about helping people who have chronic fatigue syndrome. But one person has asked whether, in your opinion, inorganic minerals, and I assume they mean synthetic vitamins, are absorbed by the body and used.
Well, I think it's always better to get our minerals from an organic source, from food. You know, so a chromium that you get from a chromium-rich plant is better than a chromium that's manufactured. But I think it's a mistake to say that, you know, something like, say, chromium picolinate, which is manufactured, is not valuable, because we know, you know, from numerous studies that it can be. I mean, I think one of the things that's been very popular in the past has been this idea of colloidal minerals. And I would say, well, gosh, you know, colloidal's good, but what's really more important is whether or not the mineral is in a natural form that our body can use or not. You know, so an example might be calcium. If you get calcium carbonate, which is sometimes, you know, found in nature, but it's largely manufactured, it's not very absorbable. But if you get, so doing better than that, if you get something like calcium gluconate or calcium lactate, which are also manufactured, they're way better than calcium carbonate. But if you get carrots that are grown in calcium-rich soil, you know, and kale and, you know, broccoli, they're all very rich in calcium, that is clearly the very best. And, you know, so you're better off to get your minerals from food or a food form. However, when people are very deficient, you know, there's certainly a therapeutic value to using these man-made chelates as a stopgap on your way back to appropriate diet and to kind of fill in. It's hard to eat enough carrots, Scott, to get somebody, if somebody's really deprived if somebody's really deprived in calcium, you know, so I make my living, you know, to a very large degree in the supplement industry, providing high quality supplements to practitioners. But I believe we should get our nutrients from food. But
well, I have to say, your company Biotics is probably, in my opinion, one of the, you know, premier, most sterling companies in terms of quality that I've seen. And I've been around the industry a lot because I, being a food and drug lawyer, you know, I've represented a lot of different companies on their legal matters for food and drug law. But I have to say, I even take your products whenever I can. I'm just a little remote sometimes from being able to buy them. But if I can get my hands on them, I definitely lean in the direction of very strongly orient myself in terms of getting Biotics brand because it's so good. So I know you're being modest about it, but you have really, my hat's off to you. You have incredible line of products, good formulas, and good quality ingredients, which is great.
Thanks, Scott. That's really kind. Do we have time for a cute little story about my son and that topic?
Yes, please. Yeah. Please.
Well, one time when he was younger, he's off in college now, but I think he was about 10 or 11, and we were coming to or from a soccer game or something, and he was sitting in the back seat with his buddy RJ, and RJ had these snack bars, and you know, they were like you know, quote unquote health bars, and my son said, "Hey, RJ told me I could have one of his snack bars." He said, "Is that okay with you, Dad?" He said, "I've already read the label. There's no hydrogenated oils or high fructose corn syrup in it," because he knew that if they had those things in it, it was completely off the table. And I said, "Well, son," I said, "even though they don't have those really bad things in it, they're still highly processed. And, you know, why don't you have an apple or, you know, a piece of cheese, that organic cheese or something like that? And I think that'd be a better choice because that's really whole food." And he stopped and thought about it for a second. And because he's a chip off the old block. You know, he's not going to just give up. So he said, well, you know, Dad, I've been thinking about it. You know, you don't want me eating processed food, but those vitamins that you sell, they're highly processed too. And so he kind of had me, you know. So my answer to him, you know, not wanting to be one up by an 11-year-old, I said, well, son, here's kind of the way it is. You know, the reason we sell those supplements, and they are highly processed, although many of them are whole food, you know, particularly with biotics, it's basically a whole food based product line. But still, even that whole food is processed to get in a pill. I said, son, if we can just get everybody to stop eating processed food, then they'll all be healthier, and then I won't have to sell those supplements anymore. And then instead of going to work every day, we can just get a sailboat. We can go sailing. So, which I really believe, you know, I mean, at this point, you know, I don't really need to make, you know, I'd rather see everybody healthy than sell supplements. But as people continue to eat these highly processed diets and particularly, with environmental stress that comes on top of that, I think for most people really can benefit from supplements, you know, until they get themselves straightened out with the whole food diet and get into a more pristine environment. So I feel really good about, you know, about helping healthcare practitioners, particularly to do really good analysis and give people the nutrients that their bodies really need, because I think that's part of the problem. You know, part of the criticism of the industry is people take things indiscriminately that they don't necessarily need and out of balance, and so they don't get the real benefit. But with with Codex, you know, they're trying to limit the amount so that people don't mess themselves up. But in the hands of a competent practitioner, you know, hopefully somebody who's taken some of my training, you know, they have the ability to really assess the body and using feedback mechanisms really know what works for whom, you know, and give them the best benefit from those supplements.
Well, let me ask you, because again, getting back to your products, are they available internationally? If, you know, we have a lot of listeners in the British Isles, and for example, and they might be interested in your product. Could they order online to get your products?
Well, the best way to get biotics research products is to go to a practitioner who's skilled in using them. And we do actually have a distributor who works with naturopaths and medical doctors and chiropractors in UK. And as you know, some of the rules there are more restrictive, so the formulations are a bit different, but they're still the same high quality. And we also have a very big presence in Europe, and we have a significant distributor in Holland, and they distribute throughout Germany and Holland, and kind of expanding into France. And you know, some of the countries are very difficult, and some of the countries like the Netherlands are relatively liberal. I used to teach classes in Holland and Belgium and Germany every year, and we had big crowds of doctors. Actually, in Germany and Holland, it was mostly medical doctors that really wanted alternatives to drugs, that were coming to learn how to use therapeutic nutrients in the best way, and you know, how to really understand, you know, and effectively use the biotics product line very specifically.
Right. Well, it makes sense. So could someone go to your website to find a list of practitioners, say, in England or Scotland or Ireland who sold your products or used them in their practice?
You know, I can't remember the exact website of the UK distributor, but if anybody's interested, they can go to bioticsresearch.com, and there'll be a list of distributors, including the one in UK and in Netherlands, and they can obtain those websites. And then from there, they can either, if you really want to find a good practitioner, I would call those distributors and say, who's your best person in, you know, London, or who's your best person in Glasgow or whatever, and they'll know who really has studied and knows how to use them the most effectively. So that's probably the best advice. We do
that's good advice, and I think anyone who's interested in that can do it, because we've had some of the listeners who are interested in knowing how to get the vitamins they can't get even now with the UK, as you were pointing out, Codex is actively striving. And I want to thank you once again for having supported our work at Codex at this last meeting, Biotics Research. You know, this is part and parcel of everything. For those of you who are listening, rather than spend your money on those companies who, you know, could care less about health freedom or your health rights, go to the companies that are supporting health freedom, like Biotics Research. These are the ones who need your support, need your business to stay in business. And in turn, they know which side, how do I put it? Which side their bread is buttered, and they know that they can, best and very ethically support health freedom, and that's what they've been doing. So we have on the chat line the information where Biotics Research is. I've actually, if I remember correctly, I've been to their facility. It was in the 1980s, so it was a while ago. It's in Rosenberg, Texas, but it's a really nicely run facility. So I want to thank you very much on this, Gray. It's been great having you on. And again, I'm a little bit apologetic here, a lot apologetic that we got a little bit of a late start because of technical reasons. But is there any last minute advice you could give our listeners just generally on nutrition before we go?
Well, I know one thing. We, a Nutritional Therapy Association, we've had an unbelievable kind of influx of new students as people want to embrace nutritional therapy as a new profession. So if there's any of your listeners that are interested in knowing more about nutrition in general or about the Nutritional Therapy Association, you can go to nutritionaltherapy.com and you can get information about diet and about what Nutritional Therapy Association or NTA is doing, and what classes might be offered in your area. And we are hoping in the very near future, we have people coming from all over the world now to attend our classes, but we're hoping in the not too distant future to have some European classes also.
So if someone wanted to do an online class, could they do that?
Well, we do actually now. We have a new program that's mostly online. So we have a new program that we're with our longtime class has been to train nutritional therapy practitioners, and they get the designation NTPs. But we have, and that does require, in addition to the hundreds of hours of online study that includes video and audio presentations, they do have to come together three times in a central location to learn all of the functional examination techniques. But we have a new class called Nutritional Therapy Consultant, and that only requires one weekend. Actually, the inaugural class is going to be in Las Vegas and starts in early 2013. And we've already signed up students from South Africa, Israel, and Australia who can make it for that one weekend. And eventually, if demand grows, we can do those classes in Holland and hopefully Australia and South Africa so that we can have larger numbers of people that don't have to come to us. So.
I see. Okay. And in any event, we put the web address, nutritionaltherapy.com, on the chat line so that people who are listening through that can get it. But again, for those of you not on the chat line, go to www.nutritionaltherapy.com, and you can see about the classes that we were just talking about. Gray, thank you so much. Now, before our listeners go and before Sean McGuire comes on as the host for the next hour, I just want to remind everyone. Well, first of all, I want to apologize for the previous absence that I had because, my mother, took very ill with a heart condition and I had to fly 6,000 miles to be back there at the hospital and deal with that situation or help deal with it and then fly 6,000 miles back here to Europe. But, and that's still not resolved, but I did miss a day when we were going to have Dr. John Cannell on, an MD who will talk about vitamin D, but we're looking at having him next week. And, I want to invite all of you who are listening to come at 8 p.m. Irish and English time, Scottish time, Welsh time, whatever, Isle of Man time, and listen, because he will be interesting too. But I really appreciate your time, Gray Graham, on this. And I would love to have you back on, Gray, because I know we barely scratched the surface of what you know about what people can do. And again, look for Gray Graham's book. It is Pottinger's Prophecy, and it's really good. I have a copy right here, and I recommend it to everyone. And so, in any event, I will leave you all with that. And it is now the top of the hour, so it's time for the irrepressible Sean McGuire. And I'll be back this time next week. And thank you all for listening. And be good and be healthy and take Mr. Graham's advice to heart, please. So you'll keep listening and keep healthy. And your great-grandchildren will also be healthy. Okay. Talk to you later.